Welcome to the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain podcast, ASRA Wrap. This is episode 26, revisiting ketamine in the perioperative arena. Welcome to the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain podcast. I'm your host, Raj Gupta, coming from Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And with me again is my co-host, Eric Schwenk from Jefferson Memorial Hospital in Philadelphia. Eric, how are you today?
Very good. Nice to be here again.
Yeah, and with us today, we have our good friend Danielle Ludwin, who is from Columbia University Medical Center in New York City. And Danielle has been so kind to join us post-call without her cup of coffee, and she's still joining us this morning. How are you, Danielle?
Good. Thanks for having me here this morning.
Well, before we get started with our topic today, one of the things I always like to do, a couple of announcements, and we have some real important announcements. Today, and I hope you're not getting this too late, if I get this out today, September 28th, is the last day for early bird registration for the fall ASRA meeting in San Antonio. If you can't catch the early bird pricing, the registration keeps going right up to the time of the meeting, so make sure you go to ASRA.com and check out all the details about the meeting. This venue looks beautiful. It's a spa, resort, water park, golf course type of facility in the outskirts of San Antonio. Looks like a gorgeous place to just spend some time. And then, of course, we've got a packed meeting for people to go to. This is the first time I'm going to go to the fall meeting. I haven't been to one. I usually go to the spring meetings. And so I'm excited to go to the fall meeting and see what the vibe is there at that meeting. So if you're there at that meeting, come say hi to me. We're going to be doing some Facebook Live from the fall meeting. So check us out there as well. And you'll find out more about that in the next few weeks. The spring meeting is right around the corner for 2019. That's going to be in April 2019 in Las Vegas. And the call for abstracts is going to come around the corner here pretty soon. And so I want you to keep an eye out for your emails and go to ASRA.com to find out about the call for abstracts for the spring meeting, which is going to be in Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. All the details for all these meetings are ASRA.com. We'd love to see you at all of these. And like I said, more than anything else, come say hi. Come find us in the hallway. We love to meet new people. We love to hear that you guys listen to us and that hear about what you guys do in your practice. So for today's topic, we are going to be talking about ketamine. So ketamine is an old drug and came out in the 70s or so, and then it's kind of getting a resurgence in modern acute pain and perioperative pain management, as well as chronic pain management in psychiatry, of all things. So there's a lot of interest in ketamine. Eric, our co-host extraordinaire, is also the lead author on a new article from Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management on the use of ketamine for perioperative and acute pain management. There's also a sister article on ketamine usage in chronic pain management. And then we also want to tap into everybody's experience with ketamine at their institutions, because we've all been using it for different amounts of time and in different capacities. So just to kind of broach the topic, Eric, I'll jump to you first. Why do you think we needed to have these articles come out in the first place?
That's kind of always the big question to ask for any of these things. I mean, do you actually need guidelines? And in the case of ketamine, I would say for sure, because the one issue is this emergence of ketamine clinics. And I kind of was skeptical when we started the project. I said, are there really ketamine clinics around the country? That sounds just sort of like a vague cop-out reason to do this kind of project. And then as I started talking to patients who get admitted to Jefferson, actually a lot of them have been treated in some of these ketamine clinics, which in essence are small practices that are run by a physician, but there has been virtually no oversight, no recommendations, no guidance in terms of monitoring, dosing, and just the kind of way they do it and the qualifications of people doing it, that we thought there was a strong need for some guidance from people who can combine their clinical experience with what's out there in the literature. And in some areas, there's not necessarily great literature. In other areas, there's there's better evidence, but nevertheless, I think that sort of unregulated use of it was one reason. The other reason is just with the opioid crisis in kind of full bloom, there's been increasing attention to ketamine as an opioid alternative. And I think people are kind of pushing the envelope with how it's being used. And with that, there's always safety and side effect issues. So all of that together, I think, kind of screamed out for the need for some recommendations.
And Danielle, do you guys have to deal with just starting from the outside coming in, but have you guys had to deal with patients going to ketamine clinics there in New York?
In our practice, I have not had that experience. I don't believe my colleagues have either. So I don't think our patient population, whether it's hard for me to say because we don't have patients. So I don't know if it's our patient population does not seek out ketamine clinics or there are less ketamine clinics in the area where I work. I'm not sure the answer to that. It's a good question.
So in Tennessee, I know that we have a huge opioid crisis problem in Tennessee. I think we're one of the top three or four states for opioid-related deaths from overdose, and then obviously the addiction and all the sequelae that comes from that. And I personally know of a few friends and colleagues that have started ketamine clinics in this area, one for veterans and one for private citizens. And, you know, they're using those clinics for people with a variety of issues that we're going to talk about today, but primarily for management of chronic pain and persistent chronic pain conditions that they've been on long-term opioids for. So, you know, it's definitely a real thing. And I hear what you're saying, Eric, about knowing what the qualifications are of the people that run these clinics. I know who these people are. I know these are trained anesthesiologists that run these clinics. So it's run by people who are very competent, but I'm sure that's not always the case.
Definitely true. There's a wide variety of skill sets, knowledge, and practices, I think, that are being performed. Just even within the working group that was involved with this paper, there was some variety. Now, there were certainly things that we agreed on, but we did some surveys and polls within the group, and there was still a fair amount of variation within the group. So I think that kind of further illustrates the point.
So Danielle, what do you think is the where do you find ketamine working in your practice there in New York at Columbia? Have you guys used it for a while?
So in our practice at Columbia, I was one of the few people using ketamine, and now it's become a lot more popular to use. And you know, especially with these recommendations coming, there's just a heightened increased interest in using it for a multitude of reasons. So I'll start with my own experience. So my clinical practice is mostly orthopedic anesthesia, although I do lots of other cases as well. And for a lot of these patients, we're doing them with regional anesthesia and sedation. So I often will use ketamine as an adjunct for sedation. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about why I think it's a really nice adjunct in certain patient populations for...
Go ahead and do that now. Talk about why you think it's a good adjunct for sedation.
A couple things. One, the fact that it's not a respiratory depressant is incredibly helpful. So one of the cases that I think it's really... really plays an important role is in shoulder surgery. So whether it's a shoulder arthroscopy or even a total shoulder replacement, these patients are often done in the beach chair or lateral positions. So we don't have as much access to the airway as we might like. And the things that I think make ketamine great in these cases are, one, it's very analgesic. So ideally, we have a perfect functioning block. If for some reason our block is not perfect, ketamine can be helpful for its analgesic properties. That's one reason I like using it. The second reason is, again, it's not a respiratory depressant. So in combining it with using propofol, I find that we can use less propofol, which is a respiratory depressant. So the patient's able to maintain spontaneous ventilation. And third, we're allowed to, you know, we're able to use less opiates for the patient. And again, that's become really a priority, much more so recently with the opiate crisis. And I found it to be a very useful part of our anesthetic plan.
Out of curiosity, how do you administer your ketamine?
Sure. So we do it as most commonly, I'll do it in an infusion. And depending on the patient, so for example, if they are on opiates, I would use more ketamine. But I tend to run them on an infusion of 3 to 5 mics per kilo per minute and bolus them. And again, it depends on the patient and a couple factors. But typically bolusing them around like 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram before the start of the case.
Yeah, a couple interesting points from what you said. Just for clarification, it sounds like you're doing your shoulders not under general anesthesia. Is that right?
So of course that's a caveat to what I'm saying. So I'm describing the typical technique we use when we're doing it with sedation. If I'm doing a shoulder with general anesthesia, then I might, unless it's a chronic pain patient. A chronic pain patient, I will tend to keep on an infusion of ketamine, whether they're under sedation or general. If it's not a chronic pain patient and the shoulder is going to be done under general anesthesia, I might still do a ketamine bolus, but I probably wouldn't do a ketamine infusion for that case. But I would say for our shoulders, and I don't know the data off the top of my head, but in my own practice, I would say about 50% of my patients having total shoulders, I do under block and sedation, and 50% under block and general. That would be a separate podcast of how I decide which category they fall into. But in terms of I have been using ketamine, I would say, for the majority of my patients, but the dosing I do change depending if it's for a case patient under sedation or a patient under general.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that it just one illustrates the differences in regional practice. I mean, our shoulders are basically done all under general anesthesia. I think it probably is more of a historical thing. The surgeons kind of are used to that and prefer that. But you know, there's no reason that a lot of them couldn't be done under sedation with a block, especially with a good block, like it sounds like you guys are doing as well. And in terms of the dosing for the infusion, what you said makes a whole lot of sense. If you take, for example, a 70 kilogram patient and use the dose you mentioned, which is 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute, that basically extrapolates out to be 20, 21 milligrams per hour, which is a fairly typical dose. You know, it sort of ends up being in the 0.25 milligrams per kilogram per hour kind of thing. We'll start most patients a little bit closer to 10 milligrams, but 10 milligrams an hour, but certainly there's plenty that will get started at a bit of a higher infusion rate. It's hard to, you know, completely standardize everybody across the institution. The other spinoff point of what you're saying, the infusion, I think, is particularly important. And in a letter to the editor about the guidelines, which is in press right now, the author of the letter brought up the point of the podcast trial. And for people who are listening who aren't familiar, the podcast trial was a multi-center randomized controlled trial that was published in 2017 in Lancet, so it got a lot of attention. And they had 600-some patients that were randomly assigned to either placebo, 0.5 milligrams per kilogram ketamine bolus, or 1 milligram per kilogram ketamine bolus intra-op. So just the bolus, no infusions given, and the patients were all 60 years and older, elderly population undergoing all kinds of surgeries. And what they found, that the study was actually designed to look specifically at postoperative delirium. It was really powered for that rather than analgesia, but they did have analgesia as a secondary outcome. And there was no improvement in delirium in any of the ketamine groups. And there was also no improvement in analgesia, which is sort of the interesting, perhaps surprising and somewhat controversial finding, especially what we all see and the fact that we, I think, all would agree that it is clearly effective. But, you know, several issues without going into extreme detail in the study, you know, they were doing it as a single bolus and there was no infusion run. You were looking at elderly people, which I guess makes sense for the delirium issue, but for a population that a lot of us are using, at least the way we use it, we have a lot of issues with substance use disorder. in the opioid epidemic setting. And a lot of these patients fall more in the 25 to 35 or 40-year-old group with substantial opioid tolerance, another thing they didn't control for whatsoever in this study. So I think what they were looking at is not the same as what a lot of us are using it for. So I'm curious if you really had seen that study at all, or if not, what your thoughts are about the isolated bolus. I think it does, at a minimum, call into question the value of just doing a single bolus, maybe up front, and maybe argues that an infusion is necessary. But I think the target population was not what we use. I don't know about you guys.
So I can talk to that a little bit. We do sort of a mixture of different ways of using the ketamine. So for example, for my total joint cases where I'm doing it under spinal and sedation, and they are usually short procedures with our surgeon, like about 2 hours or less for our total joints, total knees and total hips. For those, I'll just often do a single bolus, either 50 milligrams, which is roughly about half a milligram per kilo for most of our body habitus patients, or for our older patients, I'll even cut that back to 25 milligrams, and then I won't repeat it. And even with those doses, people do complain of some delirium in the post-op phase, but it's transient. Some of them just describe feeling a little weird or having seen colors or some other hallucinatory kind of findings. Most of them aren't bothered by it. They don't find it as a distressing thing. They find it as sort of an unusual finding. And then if we're being honest about it and a little bit lazy about setting up an infusion, some of the other ways for longer general anesthetic cases that we do, we may do a bolus up front and then of 50 milligrams, and then every hour give 25 milligrams. So that's, again, fairly consistent with the dose that you're talking about, Danielle, which is runs about 20 to 25 milligrams an hour. And that's sort of a dirty infusion technique, is just to kind of do small boluses like that. But we do frequently run infusions, especially our ERAS protocol patients. We're running lidocaine and ketamine infusions intraoperatively. And that one we're running at 5 mics per kilo per minute during the case. And then we back it down in the recovery period. And so I think that, you know, the duration of the operation is a critical component of whether you can get away, let's use that phrase, get away with just a bolus one time, or if you need to do continued dosing intermittently or an infusion.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything to add in that regard, Danielle?
Well, I think that, again, I agree with you. I think the duration of case is an important variable of how you might be managing your infusion, you know, whether you do it as a bolus every hour, that's a variant of an infusion or a true infusion, or how many pumps you have available in the room. Those are all factors that can play into it. I do want to talk a little bit more about side effects that you've experienced with it, because I think that's a really important topic. And oftentimes when I use ketamine in the OR with residents, it's the first time they've had experience with it. They all get very nervous about the patient's potential to get tachycardic and hypertensive. You know, that's their concern with us giving ketamine. And I will speak from my own clinical experience, which is I haven't found that clinically with these sub-anesthetic doses at all. I have found, though, it can increase secretions, which can be an issue, particularly in the way we're using it, which is first, sometimes, not always, but for sedation cases, which can be an issue, and that they also can have some hallucinatory feelings from it afterwards. And I think that would be interesting to flesh this out a little bit more with both of you in your own experiences.
I can speak to what I see, and also to just what kind of what we discussed based on the reviews and the guidelines, but I don't see a whole lot of that, at least clinically, in terms of giving it in the OR. Now, granted, some of that stuff is masked potentially by general anesthesia if it did exist.
Yeah.
But even on the floor, when you have patients, I mean, we're using a lot of ketamine infusions in patients who are otherwise awake on the floor, and very rarely are there hemodynamic problems. I think that it's more an expectation or a kind of a reputation as causing them than there is in reality actually that happening. And it tends to be certainly in our own specialty, but a lot of people we work with in terms of surgeons and internal medicine physicians and other people we work with have heard that ketamine is great, but it causes, you know, hypertension and tachycardia. And anytime a patient experiences that, therefore it's ketamine, so let's get rid of it, or let's, you know, kind of shut it off, that kind of thing. I do see that occasionally. And I think in those cases, sometimes we take a closer look, and in the large majority of them, I'd say there was some other identifiable thing that caused it. And, you know, in terms of the review and the chronic pain guidelines, for example, there were initial studies showing there was not much change in cardiac output, stroke volume, SVR, all these other parameters. But then, you know, subsequent studies showing a negative inotropic effect in critically ill patients. So, you know, reviews have shown some changes, I think, in terms of heart rate and blood pressure. But it's not a consistent enough effect for us to say that, you know, you should expect that. And in a lot of cases, I think it's probably a combination of factors or just something else altogether.
I think you mentioned three side effects, the secretions, the cardiovascular changes, and the hallucinations. With regard to the hallucinations and the cardiovascular changes, I think that's a lot of it's tied to either the bolus dosing versus the infusion. So when we run infusions only, I don't see much of that at all. And I think these sub-anesthetic doses of infusions, even less than 10 mics per kilo per minute, I don't think we see much of those kinds of problems. The bolus, when you give it, so if I give a bolus and I'm doing a sedation case in the operating room, I do have patients say that they had brief episodes of hallucinations. Again, like I said earlier, most of them are not distressing type hallucinations. If I have somebody who I'm concerned about, maybe somebody who has a history of PTSD or somebody, some of our elderly patients, I'll either not do a bolus or I'll do a much smaller dose. And then the infusions are usually much better tolerated in those situations. With regard to the cardiovascular changes in the operating room, in fact, it's mostly helpful because we're fighting hypotension from the spinal. If we're doing a spinal, we're fighting hypotension from the propofol. If we're doing propofol, or we're fighting hypotension from the anesthetic agents when we're doing anesthetic agents. With all the patients that we have on antihypertensives nowadays, I feel like I'm fighting hypotension more than I'm ever fighting hypertension. And so the ketamine seems to be enough sympathomimetic that we get a little bit of bolster on their hemodynamics instead of overshooting to the point where it's a problem, at least at the doses that we're using right now. Now, the secretions, we have noticed that happens quite a bit, and that's something that most of the time a little suctioning solves that problem, and it's not a big deal, but we do have a few faculty that routinely will give somebody glycopyrrolate to try to reduce their secretions. They'll preemptively pre-treat with glycopyrrolate, and but then you get tachycardia, so who's to say where the tachycardia came from in that situation? But I think these are all manageable side effects with appropriate dosing and a little bit of education of the providers and the patients about what to expect in those situations. Eric, you wanted to talk a little bit about using it outside of the operating room. That's kind of the next frontier of ketamine use. Talk a little bit about what your experience was getting that onto the floor.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interest of mine in particular, and I'd love to hear how you guys are using it at your various hospitals, so I'll try to be pretty brief. I mean, we have the fortune of being at a place where it's been established for 15-plus years that ketamine infusions on the general medical floors have been used. Gene Viscusi certainly was the large reason that is happening. We also have a team of pain nurses that give us basically around the clock coverage, at least for weekdays. And I think that confidence of having them who are trained in the side effects and are available to deal with them has sort of allowed this to happen where we don't have patients in an ICU. We don't have additional monitoring. And for example, in patients with refractory migraine, which has become a growing and even bigger part of our population here, these patients get admitted for 5 days of intensive ketamine therapy. And they, you know, the doses get pushed upwards of 1 milligram per kilogram per hour, which we kind of have as our upper limit with occasional exceptions on a case-by-case basis. But at those doses, there's going to be a fair amount of patients that are going to have some sort of side effects, whether it's hallucinations, disinhibition, you know, the general feeling of, I don't feel like I'm there. There's all kinds of ways patients describe it. And you have to have some mechanism in place to deal with that in addition to medications. And certainly some medications like benzos and clonidine patch are helpful, and we do that, but you need to have trained people to recognize them and kind of know what to do based on protocol. So I think we have that, and we're fortunate, and some other places don't quite have that yet, but there are more and more places doing it from what I gather, talking to people at meetings and just getting kind of an informal poll across the country. It's expanding, which is a good thing. We also use it for CRPS, and the evidence has been there for that since the early thousands with Schwartzman and his studies. And we'll use it for sickle cell and various other painful indications. I think those are the most popular ones other than just the acute post-op pain. But I'm curious to see what you guys are doing outside of the OR with it.
Danielle, do you guys use ketamine in just an ICU capacity or on general medical floors or not at all?
So what our most common practice of how we're using it is for either a chronic pain patient undergoing surgery who's going to be in the hospital post-op, or an extremely painful procedure or the patient has intolerance to opiates, or for some reason they'll start ketamine intraoperatively and then continue it post-operatively. That's not to say that we'd never start patients for the first time on ketamine post-operatively. We do that sometimes. I would say that the majority of our ketamine use on our floors is a continuation from ketamine started in the operating room. So for those patients, if they're doing well in the recovery room, they are able to go to a monitored floor after. They don't have to only be in the ICU. But our recommendations also depend on, you know, where the ketamine was started, how long they've been on it, what their dosages are. But that has been a recent change in our hospital. It used to be that they had to be in a more monitored setting prior to more training of our nurses so that they could go to floors with less acuity and be on ketamine.
Yeah, just real quick to interject, I had heard before from another anesthesiologist in New York that the state nursing policies were somewhat of a factor there. I don't know to what degree that's affecting it, but has that been a factor that, to your knowledge at all, with ketamine outside of the ICU?
I don't know if I can comment. I don't know if I know the answer specifically to that question, but I do know that some of it had to do with nursing training and those aspects. So I would have to look into that in a little more detail to be able to better answer that.
Sure.
And I can give you guys sort of the history of how we put, because ours is a relatively recent process, and we came at it from a different direction because the resistance to our institution was a lot about the anxiety of the people on the floors to take care of these patients, and our policymakers in our hospital to approve it for outside of the ICU use. And it took us years to go through the process of getting this approved, so it wasn't an easy thing to do. But a couple of lessons we learned in this process. One is that educating non-anesthesia providers of the comparison of IVPCA opioids versus ketamine infusions and how we've become comfortable with using IV narcotics in general care floors with their known side effects and associated morbidity and mortality events versus this sort of somewhat irrational fear of low-dose ketamine because of a perception of what problems it causes rather than the reality of what that issue is. And so it took a lot of time educating people and reminding people that if we tried to introduce IV opioid PCAs now, that nobody would want to approve that, knowing what problems that causes on a general medical floor. So that was part of our discussion. The other thing is that we found that at our institution, they were more receptive to ketamine on the floor with a narrow indication and a very defined policy and protocol. So we tied it to our colorectal ERAS protocol. That was where we started our ketamine infusion education, training, and sort of distribution into the hospital. We said, it's going to be this narrow group of patients on these defined protocols for this defined amount of time. And here are the people who are going to take care of it. And this is exactly how we're going to dose it, with no titration. And we kept it as super simple and uniform as possible. And the idea was, is that if you make that variable as a sort of a singular variable, then when there are problems, it was easier to pick up on those variable changes. So if somebody was having hallucinations, it wasn't because of a variation in dose. It was because, okay, this dose that we started out with for everybody is maybe too much, and we have to change that across the board. So that sort of process of creating a defined protocol with very narrow dosing and defined patient population allowed us to kind of push it onto the hospital floors effectively. And then we grew it from there. We said, okay, we succeeded in this protocol. Now we're going to add this group, and then the next group, and then the next group. And our processes were already existing. The infrastructure was there. So then we could kind of expand it to other places. An interesting finding out of doing it this way was that because we had very standardized dosing and stuff, is that we realized that our dosing strategy was causing problems. So we use a very low dose. We use 2.5 mics per kilo per minute, which in the dosing that they recommend in the paper, which is mics per kilo per hour, that comes out to 0.15, which is on the low end of the range that you guys describe in your paper. But we were still having patients with significant hallucinations and problems like that. And we started out early on with our bariatric surgery patients. And what we figured out is when you do a weight-based dosing, then that dose can get really high quickly relative to their maybe ideal body weight. So we said that everybody would be on this dose, 2.5 kilos, mics per kilo per minute, up to 100 kilos. And then if they're above 100 kilos, then we go to adjusted body weight when we're trying to define what their weight is going to be. And that seemed to work a lot better. We all of a sudden noticed a drop in hallucination events. And so that worked out great. So this is just a strategy for those of you who can't figure out how to introduce it into your institution, is there's different ways to do that. Eric, you guys sound like yours was more organic in the process of spreading it.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of the protocol was not as well defined, I would say, until maybe the last five to 8 years or so. But along the lines of what you said, that's why we tend to start at 10 milligrams an hour rather than telling people a certain weight-based dose. Because as you said, if you use actual body weight, you end up doing ridiculous doses. A patient weighs 120 kilograms, you know, and you end up starting at 30 milligrams an hour rather than 10. And, you know, I don't know that there's necessarily good evidence that 30 milligrams an hour for the obese patient is going to be tolerated great versus the, you know, thin patient. I think they're both still potentially at some risk of having some side effects. So we tend to not completely ignore the weight. We use weight as sort of an upper limit, but the starting point, and we tend to titrate in increments of 5 or 10 milligrams an hour rather than completely weight-based. It takes the calculation out of it, and it also prevents the large patients from getting very large doses. So, yeah.
So I want to wind down a little bit because we've kind of come to our half hour on our recording. Does anybody want to make any last comments on how you've seen ketamine used in the outpatient setting other than these ketamine clinics we mentioned at the beginning? Has that grown in your area? Danielle, have you seen any of that stuff?
I really haven't. And I don't know, maybe if I'm not asking about it, but based on, you know, taking histories on our I'm not seeing in our patient population, and it's an interesting question. So I think at our next meeting, I'm going to poll my fellow New York colleagues to see, and it may just be that our specific patient population. I will say, I think relative to what you guys are describing, we do have patients with opiate use, but I would say for the fact that we're a New York City hospital, my guess is that we're on the lower end of that in terms of what we're seeing.
Yeah, fair enough.
And Eric, do you guys see a lot? I mean, I'm thinking about patients getting it for depression management and other psychiatric conditions as well as chronic pain.
I'm not aware of a whole lot for depression, although the some of the clinics around here sort of use it for mixed and vague indications, which is one of the whole problems, is that there's really no oversight yet. One interesting thing to keep an eye on is the use of intranasal ketamine and other formulations of ketamine. Esketamine is a formulation of oral ketamine being trialed right now. It may even be available for depression specifically, and intranasal ketamine formulations are being used by some of our neurologists for migraine exacerbations. And, you know, could they be used as a bridge between intravenous therapy treatments or sort of as abortive agents? I think it certainly needs to be studied, because the evidence isn't there yet and the compounding is needed by a pharmacy. But that's one thing I would keep an eye on in the future, the very near future.
Well, this is obviously going to be an exciting topic, and it's going to be something that we're going to have to follow along with for the next few years, that I think there's going to be more and more people using ketamine appropriately, and then there's going to be, in the mix of that, people who are going to use ketamine inappropriately and probably without clear indication. So I think as leaders in this area, we're all going to have to keep monitoring what's happening in our communities and then kind of help educate providers about where this is effective and where it's not. So if you haven't already figured it out, in regional anesthesia and pain medicine are the two guideline articles regarding the use of ketamine for acute pain and for chronic pain. They came out in the July 2018 issue, so go check those out. Also, as a reminder, one more time, that go to asra.com for all the information about the meetings that are coming up, the fall meeting coming up around the corner in November, and then the spring meeting in Las Vegas in April of 2019. And then all these guidelines and stuff you can also find on the guidelines tab in the asra.com website. So that's another place to look for this information. Danielle, thank you so much for putting up with us post-call without your coffee. Hopefully you can go get some sleep now and get some rest. And Eric, thanks for joining us. And I'm glad you didn't get pulled away for clinical work at this time, but we got this great opportunity to talk.
Great conversation as always.
Yeah, my pleasure to participate with both of you as always.
All right. Thank you, guys.